Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us on The Conversation. It is Monday, July 15th. We discuss guns and ammunition in the film industry, given the dismissal of charges in the manslaughter trial of actor Alec Baldwin. How do we handle firearm safety on our local sets? We talk about knockoffs, not of European luxury items, but of folk art pieces in the Pacific, Ponape in particular. And we celebrate the arrival of the ukulele to the islands. We learn about the plans the Hawaii State Archives has to make vintage instruments available to the masses. Plus, we revisit an interview with the French ukulele musician, connecting cultures across the sea. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Questions about firearm safety on film and television sets are resurfacing after the recent dismissal of manslaughter charges against actor Alec Baldwin. Baldwin was being tried for his role in the 2021 death of cinematographer Helena Hutchins on the set of the low-budget film Rust. Earlier this year, the film's armorer, Hannah Gutierrez-Reed, was found guilty of involuntary manslaughter and sentenced to 18 months in prison. The Conversation's Russell Subiono was curious about what safety protocols are in place here in our local film industry. He sat down with Tui Scanlon and Irish Barber in our studios this morning. Scanlon is the president of Local 665, the International Alliance of Theatrical and Stage Employees. Barber is the business representative. The labor group represents members who work on film and television sets, like the prop master and the armor. We start with Barber.
Coincidentally, we had firearm safety training this weekend, and we flew in an armorer. In the film industry, the props assistant that's assigned to weapons handling is given the title of armorer and the responsibility. It's very lengthy to become one. You have to have months of certification, licensing, and then, of course, you have to sign for the weapons. And the weapons that are rented from the prop house come through HPD and are cleared through HPD policy. And they never leave the site or care of the armorer. So the armorer takes great pride and responsibility in securing the weapons for filming and also for the handling of the weapons.
Where is the prop house? Is it out of state?
California.
California.
And then there's also the industry-wide labor management safety committee that issues several different bulletins for various safety concerns. You can look it up at csatf.org. Bulletins 1 and 2 are for firearms and munitions. And there are very, very strict and specific circumstances where live ammunition is actually allowed on set, but it's only by peace officers, police officers, military personnel. The only time that a live ammunition firing should occur is at the range under supervision of a trained professional or peace officers. It's either there for the production of an actual gunshot for the sound department for audio or for actor training and for safety training. Aside from that, those are the only circumstances that there should ever be live ammunition on set. It should never, ever be, you know, mixed with any of the prop munitions, any of the dummy rounds. None of that should ever contaminate the ammunitions of the prop safe.
So it sounds like there's some pretty rigorous protocols just in terms of getting the firearms here, and then the responsibility of the person that oversees the armor, that oversees all of the firearms on the set.
Yeah. And in the safety bulletin, it's the prop master. But the prop master encompasses the prop master, the assistant prop master, and the armorer. But the term is used as a catch-all, that it's the prop master's responsibility, but it's the armorer ultimately. And whoever is handling the firearms within those three, that's still caught under the catch-all term, the prop master.
Safety bulletin number 1 specifically handles prop firearms and says never ever should we be using live ammo. But safety bulletin number 2 says if we have to use live ammo, then we'll follow these policies. And it's been in force for, I want to say, like 100 years.
Yes, since Cecil B. DeMille, that was the first I think, documented case of a death on set because of firearms.
Negligence.
The director, I think it was 1915, said, no, use live ammunition. It'll make it sound better. It'll look better to shoot through the door. And it shot an actor, and that actor died instantly. And it was tragic.
Have we ever had any close calls on any sets here in Hawaii?
We've never used live ammo on any of our films that we know of. The four deaths that have happened on film sets, none of them in Hawaii, were due to not following the protocols in the safety bulletins. But we are very safe. The safety bulletins have been revised because of the rust situation, but only as a matter of public policy to do something because of rust, not because there was something wrong with the protocol.
That was another question that I had. When the incident on rust happened, did it give film crews an opportunity to kind of look at protocols and maybe strengthen them? Or
I think the first reaction was the shock of it, that one of us had fallen as a result of a lack of concern for safety. And when I say that, I don't say that lightly, in that no workplace incident is an isolated incident all by itself. It is a cascade of many different things contributing to ultimately the death of a worker on set and the injury of another worker on set, in that it was the union crew had complained that this low-budget movie was placed in a equidistant from the major city centers of Albuquerque and Santa Fe, just outside of the radius where they would have had, the producers or the employers would have had to supply housing. Because of that, there were long drives back and forth for the crew, no housing and long days at work for what seemed rather unorganized. The union crew then said, we want housing because this is unsafe for us to drive this far. The producers elected then to remove all of the union crew and bring in non-union crew, brought in an inexperienced armorer who had one or two credits to her name before that, notably firing off a full load blank. So blanks come in several different categories. There's a quarter load, half load, and full load. A full load is the same amount of gunpowder and accelerant that you would use in a normal bullet, just minus the projectile. A half load is half of that, and a quarter of that is quarter of that. And full load is very loud. And she famously let off a full load round very close to Nicolas Cage's ear without warning anybody. So that's the level of expertise. So no longer competent or expert level of experience with these firearms and handling them. Live ammunition was mixed with the dummy round ammunitions. For some reason, they didn't use a rubber gun for rehearsal, which they absolutely should have used. It was revolver and not a semi-automatic pistol, so that's another factor. The first assistant director was the person to hand the firearm to Alec Baldwin instead of the armorer and just declared that it had been cleared. And so all of these things culminate with the death of one of ours, you know.
I know that ultimately the prop master, the armorer are responsible for firearm safety. Is there any responsibility for the actor to double check the firearm? I had a role on 5-0, the second to the last episode. I played a security guard. There was a rubber gun in my holster, but when the armorer came and gave me the gun, he had me put my hands on it so that I could tell that it was rubber, it was solid, and it wasn't a real gun. I've been through enough firearm training to know that you always check it. You always check it for yourself.
Always.
Always. So is there some responsibility on an actor in general to double check the firearm when he receives it from the armorer?
Well, when we speak to the armorers, it is their responsibility ultimately to make sure the firearm is safe. And if the actor has experience with firearms, they're going to do it themselves. So they're actors, right? Yeah. And they're handed props. And this dismissal of Alec Baldwin, had he been convicted, all actors would have refused to handle firearms in films. So it comes with a lot of responsibility and I think professionalism on the armorer's side to make sure that the actor is knowledgeable in handling the weapon. But in the end, it's the armorer's job to make sure it's safe, and that's why someone's in jail right now.
To build on that, you know, safety is everyone's responsibility on set. Within your realm of influence, it is the armorer's responsibility to ensure that everyone receives safely maintained and safe firearms, and that all of the things, all of the many factors that go into that are explained to the actor. The actor also has a responsibility to ask those questions. There's a famous clip of Will Smith in front of a table full of pistols, I think for the Suicide Squad movie, where someone picks up a pistol and idly waves it and he slaps it out of the person's hand, unloads the mag, slide locks the gun, checks that it's clear, puts everything back together and hands it back, pointed barrel down. But I think, you know, the first AD also has a hand in this as well, because the first assistant director is the safety officer for the film. I think the producers and executive producers also have a hand in this, because they're supposed to be competent, at least aware of the many factors that go into providing a safe workplace. So ultimately, the firearm itself is the armorer's responsibility, but a safe set is everyone's responsibility, especially those in leadership.
To your point, Russell, there were many opportunities for someone to stop that tragedy from happening. All of them were just ignored, right? Well, like you said, the actor could have cleared it. The AD could have looked down the barrel. Someone could have asked. Anyone from the crew can ask, may I look at the barrel of the gun at any time? He could have aimed off center from the camera. Any of those could have happened and prevented this, but those sequence of events lined up tragically.
And when I worked on Hawaii 5-0 as an assistant prop master and worked with the armor to outfit the first team, right, the folks who are the main cast members, to walk up to them and trained in showing them the slide locked gun, that the chamber is empty, this magazine is empty, also there's a plug in the barrel, so take a flashlight while pointed down, point it up the barrel and show that this light is not passing through.
Yeah.
Right, so the many different safety factors that are involved in this, then handing it to them and putting it in their holster and doing it in clear view of everyone that's around us so that they also know that this firearm is cold, this firearm is safe. As far as the ruling, what a critical miscalculation by the prosecution.
Yeah.
That, again, the end result is a culmination of many factors rolling into that and across the finish line. I'm still surprised that they didn't go for criminal negligence, because that is something that has normally been associated with film injuries and film deaths. That folks at the helm, for which Mr. Baldwin was an executive producer, should have known the inner workings of the workplace that he was creating, albeit a low-budget one that didn't provide housing, that hired a non-union crew, that had people that mixed ammunition after taking folks on to the firing range and all of those many things. To be criminally negligent and to not be paying attention so much so to the point where that same person is holding a firearm that was known to go off without pulling the trigger, that had a loose hammer basically, and popped off a round that wasn't a dummy round, that didn't have it inspected and didn't ask those questions. Ultimately, there is someone who has been convicted of involuntary manslaughter for the death of Helena Hutchins. It is just a shame that in this high profile case that a critical miscalculation was then capitalized on, and for something somewhat unrelated, that executive producer has no responsibility, no accountability held to him.
I just want to wrap up with a couple of questions. Last year, the Writers Union and the Actors Union both went on strike for an extended period of time. I just kind of want to get a pulse for how crews are, you know, how they're recovering from that, and just where we stand today. I know there's only one series filming here. I'm not sure if any productions are coming, but how are local crews today in light of the strike and kind of what seems like a lull in productions right now?
The entire industry is struggling right now. Last year, we had NCIS cancel, Doogie cancel, Magnum cancel. We are blessed to have the one TV series that's shooting on the North Shore right now. We had just started to recover from COVID when that happened. And right now, until I believe the agreements with the Teamsters and the Basic Crafts finish, we just finished our agreement and we're getting ready to ratify it. I think once the industry and the employers see that those agreements are in place, they can start to budget and we're hoping bring jobs back. But it's been very challenging and we have very little on the horizon coming. We're hoping for pickups of TV series that we've shot already. Chief of War, we're hoping this lifeguard movie gets picked up.
Yeah, we're lucky in that we're a mixed local, a true mixed local in that there are studio mechanics locals that just do everything film. There are craft-specific local chapters of the IA that do just that craft on film and TV projects and commercials. But we also do stage, live events, and trade show and conventions. So there is some other work, but it's still not nearly the same volume as having three shows in town filming at the same time. I think everybody's anxious to get back to work. Our ratification vote is underway as we speak, and we'll see what that looks like by the middle of the week, how the rest of the nation feels. 14 have reached a tentative agreement with the employers and for their contract. The area standards agreement that we fall under, along with the rest of the nation, has also reached a tentative agreement. So we're hopeful that this and other negotiations go as well as possible.
Well, Tui and Irish, thanks so much for coming into the studio this morning.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
And that was Tui Scanlon and Irish Barber of IATSE Local 665, which is the union that represents film and television crews, as well as crews for other live productions in our state. They were talking to HPR's Russell Subiona this morning.
Support for HPR comes from Haleakala Ranch with a legacy of livestock, conservation, and land stewardship since 1888, working to restore, maintain, and preserve the open vistas and natural beauty of Maui. More at HaleakalaRanch.com.
Parkinson's disease is a condition associated with slowing down in movements like walking, speaking, and more. I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak. Join me today on The Body Show. We'll talk about a new therapy using music to help. That's today at 6:30 on The Body Show.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Gas, celebrating 120 years in Hawaii and working to provide renewable, locally sourced energy options to fuel the next 120 years. HawaiiGas.com.
Often hear about knockoffs when it comes to European luxury brands like Chanel or Louis Vuitton, but what if it happens here in the realm of folk arts in our own backyard? Here to talk about that is HPR reporter Cassie Ordonio. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so tell us, what are we focusing on exactly?
So in today's story that I wrote about and reported on is that the traditional, or actually the contemporary art form of uros making, which is the Pohnpeian embroidered skirt, is being culturally appropriated by Pakistan manufacturers. So normally you see like Pohnpeian women or Micronesian women making the skirts, sewing them by either hand or the sewing machine, and you see this black skirt with embroidered floral patterns and just anything related to Pohnpei's culture in the Federated States of Micronesia. But they're seeing their art basically borrowed or stolen and sold in Pakistan. We would see that in Tonga when their tapa designs were stolen by Indonesian manufacturers. But in this case, this is actually kind of a new problem that we're seeing in the Federated States of Micronesia, but also in the U.S. diaspora, Hawaii, and even in Guam.
But wow, all the way in Pakistan.
Yeah. So, you know, for the uros, the Pohnpeian women who make it, they make it within 2 days max, depending on the design. And it costs $100 each uro, so this very expensive. And it's one of Pohnpei's economic drivers. And it's also, it represents their culture in a way. And I spoke with McGarry Miguel, who's a vice speaker of the Pohnpei legislature, who says uros is significant in to Pohnpeian women.
Uros is really striping because it is the product that women can really make good money out of, other than the other things not making good money like rose. So the woman is really making money out of rose. Many of our tailors, they don't graduate school, but they go back and fully committed to work with skirt And if they're very active in making skirts, they earn good money, more better than those working at the government or working at the private sectors. So I will say that the interest of making skirts is striving, is really getting bigger with our young women and the young generation.
So it's a very important part of Pohnpei's culture. But in the last 2 years, there's been manufacturers in Pakistan who's been mass producing the skirts and selling them at a cheaper price than what Pohnpeian women would sell them for. For example, depending on the design, the cheapest design of an uros made by a Pohnpeian woman is $50. And then the average cost of an uros is about $100. Can go up to $150 to $200, especially if you're accounting for like the shipping costs, if you're going to ship from Pohnpei to the U.S. mainland or Hawaii and whatnot. But if you compare that to the prices in Pakistan, they sell them for as cheap as $20.
Wow.
$20 each, I mean. So I did talk to a few Micronesian sources. Some of them weren't comfortable with being in this story because not a lot of people want to admit that they bought from these manufacturers and not from their, you know, their own women and culture. So one person I talked to who did not want to be named in the story, he actually FaceTimed with the manufacturer called, I don't think it's Sultan Ali, but some manufacturer in Pakistan that he didn't want to give. And all you see is just boxes of oros. We'll call them the fake skirts or the manufactured kind, and they're all sold by the dozens. And he said that some prices can be even cheaper. It can be $17 for the skirt, but if you order more than 100, then they'll lower it to 15. And so he said, I asked him if he was going to be selling these skirts since he's based here in Hawaii, and he said no, it was kind of more of a curiosity for him on the quality of the skirt, and you know, the prices really caught him. And so I spoke with Micronesian poet Emily Sherkileng. She did her PhD thesis on the uros, and she said this issue first arose in the early 2000s when the Philippines mass produced a skirt.
Years ago, when those Filipino skirts were popular, I was gifted a few of them, and I would just kind of wear them around the house, but they didn't last very long, and I have yet to be gifted a fake skirt made in Pakistan. And if anyone was to give me one, I would just tell them that I refuse, because I feel like we really need, Pohnpeian women especially, need to actively not support that business, because we don't want it taking over, and it already is. Because I've noticed online a lot of women wearing those, Pohnpeian women, but also I've seen a lot of Chukis and Kwashayan women wearing them, probably more than the Pohnpeian women, I'd say. So it's very scary and dangerous. I want to talk to some other women about what we can do about it. I'm really concerned.
Yeah, so she sounds like she wants them to boycott it.
She does want them to boycott it, and there are issues with intellectual property protections against these cultural artifacts or these locally produced skirts, because I know in the Federated States of Micronesia already made it illegal within its country to duplicate local products such as custom designed handicrafts and the uros, although implementing the law is currently underway. So when I was talking to Vice Speaker McGarry Miguel, it sounds like the law did pass, but it's the implementing process is the problem. But that still doesn't stop Pakistani manufacturers from selling elsewhere, because that law in FSM is only particular to their borders. But the thing is that there are Micronesians in the diaspora, and it's growing because of the Compacts of Free Association, the treaties that these Pacific nations like FSM, for example, has with the U.S. So what's interesting, what Emily Sherkileng said in her last soundbite is that, you know, at first seamstresses, Pohnpeian seamstresses, were worried about their designs being culturally appropriated by foreign manufacturers, but it's actually their own people who are doing it. So when I reached out to Sultan Ali on Facebook last week and asked, like, when did you get into the skirt making? How did you get the designs of the uros? They started selling the uros about 6 months ago, and how they got into it is that there are Pohnpeians and other Micronesians who are sending them the designs. And then once they get the designs from that Micronesian individual, they take those designs and put it in a computer, and that computer is linked to this giant mass like sewing machine. And so if you go on Facebook, they actually have it posted on there where there's like lines of fabric, just one not even cut yet, and this rows of sewing machines that are already sewing the work. And the designs are actually very similar to some of the authentic oros that we see, the ones with the hibiscus, the sakao bowl, the Pohnpei flower crown. That's all incorporated in there. So they're getting the designs from the people themselves.
Yeah, it's interesting to see when they mass produce, you know, and the quality goes down.
You know, it's the thing about copyright issues. So Keelang says one idea could be educating the community or even boycotting the fake skirts.
There's those issues of copyright, which I've read about a bit in terms of Tapa Designs and, Chong'en Ngatu and Masi, Fijian Masi Designs. So it's really hard because you see them being taken oftentimes by these corporations and kind of stealing just like sometimes just part of it or like a flower design and appropriating it. It's very challenging. I mean, it takes a lot of time and effort, people pulling together to monitor and safeguard our cultural heritage.
Yeah, it's a sense of pride, right? So you want people to get the authentic skirts and not ones made offshore.
Yeah, and there's still more work on the ground to do to educating the Micronesian community about this issue.
All right, well, thank you so much. That was HPR's Cassie Ordonio talking to us about how knockoffs of traditional Micronesian skirts has sparked a conversation among folk artists in Pohnpei.
My sister, try people we don't. We gotta be strong and just hold on to each one. Never believe in anything they say. Just try to love the life you live, yeah. One life, so live it up. Don't you give it up. Don't you feel like you ain't worth it all.
Hi, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, host of On Point from WBUR. Every day, On Point tries to help make sense of our world. We'll learn together, challenge our thinking, we'll meet some amazing people, and hopefully we'll have some fun too.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Support for HPR comes from the Office of Elections, reminding residents that Hawaii is a vote-by-mail state. Registered voters can expect to receive their primary election ballots by July 23rd. Elections.hawaii.gov.
Marketplace is here to help you make sense of this new economic reality. We know that you rely on trusted journalism to navigate this uncertainty, and that's a privilege and a responsibility that public media takes seriously. And we are committed to connecting the dots for you through these times. So please join me, Kai Rizdal, every weekday on Marketplace.
Beginning this evening at 6, following All Things Considered.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Today we're exploring the bookshelves in search of a novelist whose successful first book was loosely based on his military experience in Hawaii. In the years before World War II, our mystery author served in the Hawaiian Division, a part of the U.S. Army dedicated to the defense of our islands. The division was one of the last to be named rather than numbered and was later absorbed into the 27th Infantry. The story that he would pen was focused on a group of soldiers at Schofield Barracks in the months leading up to the Pearl Harbor attack. His debut novel won the National Book Award and was named one of the 100 best novels of the 20th century by the Modern Library Board. It was later made into a film, a television show, and even a stage musical. For this morning's backyard quiz, we're looking for the author's name. Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets an HPR reusable tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, supporting nonprofits such as the Molokai Affordable Housing Alliance, providing Kupuna with resources for building affordable homes on Molokai. NareitHawaii.com.
Tens of thousands of people will descend on Milwaukee for the Republican National Convention next week. Delegates from across the country will officially choose their nominees for president and vice president, and the GOP will make its case to the nation. I'm Susan Davis. Join me all next week for live special coverage of the Republican National Convention from NPR News.
Beginning Monday through Thursday at 4 p.m.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Board of Water Supply with a mission to provide fresh water to the people of Oahu, committed to conserving and protecting Oahu's water resources since 1929. BoardofWaterSupply.com.
This month, Roy Sukuma will be inducted into the Ukulele Hall of Fame for his efforts in promoting the Ukulele Festival for many decades. It's one of many events planned to honor the introduction of the instrument from Portugal back in 1879. We invited Hawaii State Archivist Adam Jansen into our studio this morning to talk about what we can look forward to in the weeks and months to come.
We're coming on the 145th anniversary of the arrival of the Ravenscraig, which brought three Madeirans over. Manuel Nunez, Augusto Diaz, and Santo. And they are the ones who took the traditional Madeiran instruments and created what we know today as the ukulele.
The jumping flea.
That's right.
How are we going to celebrate this big anniversary?
We're very excited that we have the International Ukulele Festival of Hawaii coming up at the end of this month. And to help educate all of these ukulele lovers of where this instrument came from, we've actually worked with the government of Madeira to have two Madeiran musicians come over bringing these traditional instruments. They're going to be at the festival. They're going to play these instruments so you can hear, you know, what did the parent instruments, the rajau and the machete, sound like when they came over. And then they're also going to be part of our educational zone so that the public can come and talk with these two incredible musicians. They're professors. They love education. And actually, you know, see the instruments and try them out themselves.
And so was there a great deal of modification?
There wasn't. It was more of a synthesis of the size and the tuning. And so it's a very subtle evolution, but more so it's the way it's played. The type of music when it came to Hawaii changed dramatically from what they played in Madeira and still play today. And so that's one of the things that we're excited about is the public will have an opportunity to hear how these three Madeirans took that instrument and made it Hawaiian.
We've done stories with you just about the string instruments and the incredible collections that we have from yesteryear. And they're just fabulous. I mean, when you hear the sound, I don't know, they just seem so much warmer. I don't know what it is.
Well, that's one of the things that the Hawaii State Archives is trying to help educate the populace on. We've acquired a good number of vintage instruments going back to the 19-aughts, and we are positioning ourselves to make those instruments available to the public to play, and not just play the original instruments, but play them with the types of strings that would have been on them when they were made, which means we're not doing the high-tech, fancy chlorofluorocarbons and all of the new strings. We're actually having handmade gut strings put on these instruments so that they do sound exactly like they would have back in the 19-teens, 20s, 30s.
So that's the warmth that I'm hearing, and it's not the nylon, it's the gut.
It is. It's the gut string, and we've already had some well-known musicians come in and play them, and it's interesting to them because it has a much different texture because it is hand-twisted and hand-wound, and the instruments themselves are much, much lighter than what we build today, because what most people don't realize is the gut strings were lower tension. Lower tension means you don't have to have as much bracing. And so as a result, these tiny instruments have huge voices. It's, you know, people look at it and goes, where's all that sound coming from? And that's also a warning to people who actually acquire these vintage instruments that you have to be cognizant of this. If you put modern strings on it, you're going to tear this instrument apart.
That is interesting. I never thought of that before, but it certainly gives you pause when you see an ukulele in a store, or, you know, maybe you've got it in a case somewhere in the closet.
And it's an interesting experience for people who've never actually played these instruments with the original gut strings. And it's something we're very excited. If you come down to the Ukulele Festival on July 27th, the State Archives is going to bring out 10 vintage instruments that we're going to allow the public to play. So we encourage you to come early because we'll be signing people up for 10-minute slots. And once it's full, it's full. But we want people to have that experience twofold. One, so that they can have a traditional experience of what these instruments were like. And secondly, we hear so many stories about auntie who had a vintage Martin or a vintage Kamaka, and they used to play it, and, you know, they miss it. You know, they don't know what happened to the instrument, but it has such a distinct sound that just playing that instrument really brings back all of those memories for them, and they can reconnect with some of their kupuna who may have passed on. And for us, that's what the archives is all about, is that discovery process and reconnecting to our past.
Well, you know, I just love it because, you know, we've had the ukulele virtuosos, right? We've had Taimani and we've had Jake Shimabukuro. Yeah, I mean, just to see these young people take this instrument and take it to a whole nother level is amazing.
We had the fortunate opportunity to actually film a short PSA with Jake Shimabukuro, and we had brought out some of our original vintage 100-plus-year-old instruments. And you know, we had a Martin 5K from 1927 with gut strings, and we handed it to him. And you can tell when people get it, because the awe and reverence that he approached this with, it was amazing. He's one of the finest ukulele players in the world. And he's looking at this going, wow. So if he's going, wow, you know you've got something special. And to be able to replicate that experience for more people is really going to be a wonderful, wonderful thing.
So folks will be able to pick it up at this festival. And can you share with our listeners what the archives has up its sleeve?
Well, most certainly. We are coordinating an educational zone at the International Ukulele Festival, July 27th at Kapiolani Park. Festivities start at 9, they go until 6. And during that entire time period, we will have a tent in this educational zone where we're going to bring all these instruments down. And it's the start of something much larger for us. We're spinning up a project that we're calling the Hawaiian Music Archives at the Hawaii State Archives, because we have recently acquired an incredible richness of music-related materials that we really can thank Uncle Harry B. from Territorial Airwaves for, and his lovely wife, Kilohana Silv. They donated all of the Territorial Airwaves and Kilohana's hula materials to the archives. And that set off an incredible chain of fortunate events where a gentleman who had taught ukulele for 40 years heard about that and said, hey, can I donate all of my ukulele and 12 boxes of Hawaiian sheet music to you? And then another gentleman donated almost 200 Edison cylinders dating back to the 1900s, 1910s of Hawaiian music. And so we're now in the process of starting to digitize all of that historic sheet music, all of the Edison cylinders, the Edison diamond discs, the old 78 shellac records. And we want to put anything out of copyright online so that everybody has access to it all over the world. Because we think that these songs have a lot to teach us today still. Because the mo'olelo contained in those songs are very powerful. They may not have been popular after they were originally recorded, but now that we look back 100 years later, they take on a special significance. You know, they may be talking about an event, an individual, or a apua'a that just doesn't feel or look the same anymore. So we're very interested in what this is going to mean for researchers, historians, and musicians, you know, looking for new material to be able to play. We're hoping to be able to reinvigorate some of these classic songs that kind of fell out of the public play lists and be able to inject them back in.
And you have a project also in the works where you'd like to have a soundproof booth in the archives?
That is correct. We can really thank Sean Yakavone of Ukulele Friend for this. You know, he has the most incredible collection of Kingdom era ukulele in the world. And he frequently brings them to events to let professional musicians play a hand-built Nunez from 1890. It's just unheard of. You know, most of these things are in a museum behind glass. And he has really instilled upon us that to do that is a disservice. You know, these were built to have a voice. And if you don't string them, if you don't play them, they lose that voice and therefore they lose that purpose for what they are. It's like taking a painting, hanging it on a wall and throwing a blanket over it. You know, oh, I'm going to protect it from light. Yeah, but nobody can appreciate it. So that got us thinking about, we allow people to come into the archives and see incredibly rare and unique letters, like the handwritten letters from Mo'i Kalakaua and his trip around the world. You can come in and ask to see those and we hand them to you. Why would we not do that with instruments? Yes, it's rare, but I can buy another one of them if anything goes wrong. So we're putting this sound booth in the research room. So just like any other archival material, you can come in, request to see it under controlled, careful, observed conditions, and be able to play that 1919 Kamaka Pineapple or that Martin Style 3 that was so popular with all the recording musicians in the 20s and 30s. And it's really opening up the archives to a whole new base of patrons that otherwise would never come into the archives. But now that there's this music-related material, they're like, oh, when can I come down? So we're excited to get that moving. It's taken a little longer than we wanted to. But, you know, all I could say is, you know, follow us on Facebook or Instagram and follow the announcements of when we're going to launch.
Okay, and you'll get the news flash.
Yes.
But it's neat because you draw people in and then they learn more about the public archives and then maybe they'll go down another rabbit hole.
And that's really what it's about, because as an archivist, all of my formal training has been to protect the record, you know, traditionally very paper-based.
Yeah, documents.
But Hawaii is such an oral tradition. Haumana learn from kumu, and you learn at their feet, and they recite, you return. None of it's ever written down. So a lot of these early stories only exist in this recorded vocal format. And so for us, it's an extension of that preservation of Hawaii's history in a way that we've never embraced before. And so we're again, excited to see what does this do for scholarship or just general public awareness and appreciation of the origins of Hawaiian music.
For many years now, there's been talk of opening up a museum to honor mele and hula. And that hasn't come together, but this sounds like this is the beginnings of it anyway.
We're hoping to. We're working with the Hawaiian Legacy Foundation and the Hawaiian Music Hall of Fame, because we all have the same interest. And so we're trying to figure out how do our different initiatives and missions align to hopefully move more toward that direction.
Yeah, well, it's an exciting time. And we appreciate you sharing some of these ideas. And for the festival, I know you folks are looking for volunteers.
Yes, that would be great. So running a festival of this size, we're expecting 5,000 plus people, incredible artists, Jake, Mika, Kala'e, Raiatea. We're having musicians from France and South Korea and Japan fly in. So to do that, we need volunteers. So if you're interested in volunteering and willing to help out for 4 hours or more, you get free parking, a t-shirt, and lunch. So if you something that interests you, please email us at musicarchives@hawaii.gov and we'll get you connected with the coordinators.
Okay. All right. Well, it sounds like a great event, a great way to celebrate the Jumping Flea. And thank you again for coming in the studio and sharing this with our listeners.
It's always a pleasure, Catherine. Thank you.
That was Hawaii State Archivist Adam Jansen talking about the introduction of the ukulele here in the islands, traveling all the way from Portugal. And in a nod to the global reach of the humble instrument, we hanaho our conversation with French musician Matthias Chenin-Val, also known as Matthias CV. He lives in the south of France and made his own ukulele with a D-hole in the gypsy jazz style. He was inspired to learn more about Hawaii and particularly enjoys listening to Jake Shimabukuro.
I discovered the ukulele at the same time than the gypsy jazz when I was 12 or 13. And I fell in love of the sound of the ukulele and the playing. And I fell in love too of the richness of gypsy jazz, and I wanted to combine both of them because it was not usual and promising.
And you don't see very many gypsy jazz style ukulele out there.
No, there is one in Spain, Albert Bello, who play and he make an album like 5 or 10 years ago of gypsy ukulele, but he don't play with metal string. He play with nylon string, so it's not the same sound as the typical sound of gypsy jazz.
What is it about gypsy jazz that you love so much?
I love the simplicity and it's very complicated and very simple because everybody can understand and listen to it with pleasure. But it's also a style, very abouti. I don't know the word in English, but it's good. It's brilliant. It's a brilliant style, but for everybody.
And you have videos online of you playing a number of classic Django songs. Have some videos of you playing out on the street with other musicians. Yeah. Tell us about that.
It's two different things. I made videos from my house because I love it. It's a good way to keep contact with internet and to have fun. And I played with friends for professional since like 8 years and since 3 years as a professional, a real professional. And we played too for the pleasure, but also for leave.
And what is the name of the group that you play with when you do gypsy jazz out on the streets?
Yeah, in the street, it's a Tabas band in the video. And now it's with Gigambitus or other band where I play. But Tabas band. But I have also a lot of different band and show not gypsy jazz exclusively. I don't, I play more gypsy jazz in my videos than in a live concert.
I see. And then you also have another group that you belong to, Ukulele Syndicate. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the Big Ukulele Syndicate is a band from Grenoble. And we are 12 on the stage with two singers, and we play a lot of songs, very popular. It's like not theater, but it's a story. The concert is like a story, and we made a lot of noise, and the people are dancing, and it's always a good time for us and for the audience. It's a big show.
Is there anything that you would like to share with our listeners just about your love for ukulele?
It's amazing, ukulele. You can play it easy, and you can also play it hard and make beautiful music and complicate. It's not a toy. The first appearance of the ukulele is like a mini guitar, but it's not a mini guitar. And in France, it's that. There is a fashion, a ukulele fashion, but it stays the mini guitars for the people. And I want to defend the others. Ukulele is an instrument, a fabulous instrument. I love traditional music from all the world, and I have a big collection of traditional instruments. And ukulele is my mon coup de cœur, my heart call, you know.
Is it your favorite?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah,
I love it.
That was French musician Matthias CV sharing his love for the ukulele. What about that band, Ukulele Syndicate? Again, think thumb-in-cheek, an ukulele band with a sense of humor that will have you smiling if you watch them online. And now it's time for the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier, we told you about a novelist whose first book was loosely based on his experience serving in the U.S. Army's Hawaiian Division, which was later absorbed into the 27th Infantry as Company E. The book story was told through the eyes of protagonist Robert E. Lee Pruitt and was titled From Here to Eternity, which came from Rudyard Kipling's poem Gentlemen Rankers. It was a debut novel from author James Jones, which was the answer to today's backyard quiz. The book hit the stands in 1950 and was awarded the prestigious National Book Award a couple of years later. The story also was made into a hit film starring Burt Lancaster, Montgomery Clift, Donna Reed, and Frank Sinatra back in 1953. Movie buffs may recognize that love scene between Lancaster and Deborah Kerr, which was filmed at Helona Beach Cove on Oahu's southeast shore. In 2002, From Here to Eternity was selected for preservation in the U.S. National Film Registry by the Library of Congress as being culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant. That was our quiz today. We have no winners. We stumped you on that one. If you have an idea for a quiz, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. That is it for us today. Tomorrow, we learn more about an effort behind using campaign funds for childcare. What are your thoughts on this issue? Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217. You can find the conversation on our website or as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or Google. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of the conversation.